everybody. Welcome to Defiant Hustle. I'm Noreen. And we have with us today my co-host Daisy Mello.
Oh, hey.
And we have Bob at the controls there tonight.
Oh, I get to speak?
You get to speak.
Just now. Louise, that's it, Bob.
Everybody,
we're talking.
Bob. That's it. You got your moment. And we have with us today somebody very, very, very impressive and honorable. We have with us today our Greenwich local and Senator Alex Bergstein. So welcome, Alex.
Thank you. Great to be here.
It is great for we really are thrilled to have you here today. And you've been working really hard since you've taken this position, right? And so you beat the five-time incumbent in November.
Yes.
I want to get into everything you've put forth since you started, but just briefly for our audience, I wanted to get into the mindset you had before you decided that you wanted to run for senator.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the mindset I had was that I would never run for office because I truly did not have any interest in being a candidate or being having visibility on myself. But what I've spent my career doing is drawing visibility to issues that I care about. So I am an attorney by trade. I am an advocate for issues that I'm passionate about. I started and ran numerous nonprofits because there are so many good solutions to the problems we have out there. And I just wanted to draw attention to good policy and get that in place. So I didn't have an interest in being the visible person, but when I realized that no one else was going to run, I felt so passionately that someone should run for this seat. And someone said to me, you know what? Just think of yourself as a conduit. You're just a conduit for the ideas and the energy. And that was a light bulb moment when I realized, okay, I can put myself out there and be fearless because whatever comes at me, it's not really about me. It's just, you know, people project their own stuff, and I can just be the conduit.
So what is it like? So now you've won.
Yeah.
And we were going, you've put so many things into action right away, which is different than we may have seen from other people who often politic with a lot of rhetoric but don't necessarily take those actions. Or I don't know, they sort of go quiet after they get behind the scenes. But we're going to go into a lot of what you worked on. But I was wondering, because when we put the post up that you were coming on the show, even we, and when I say we, it's Daisy and I, were putting the posts up.
No, I'm getting blamed.
And we had people going after us. How are you handling some of the environment today and the negative feedback?
Yeah, I'm actually handling it really well because the only reason I ran is to, again, to draw attention to the big issues and the real solutions that we could put in place if we had the political will, if people were informed and engaged and we could put our partisan differences aside. So I don't think about, my next race. I don't think like a politician. I'm never thinking about my brand or my profile. I just want to get everyone engaged in constructive discussion. So I'm an academic. That's the world I come from. And you just gather the facts, you do the research, you go to experts, you have a dialogue and a discussion, and then you move forward. And that's how it works in theory in the business community too. You gather the facts and you figure out what's in the best interest of the group, of the whole, and you have, you know, a vision of where you want to go, and then you execute it. That's what we should be doing in our public policy too. And the system is broken, the dynamic is broken, people are in their partisan camps, but we can fix it. And I already feel that we've made tremendous strides.
Well, I think you have, like, you started these community engagements that you had one last week, but that's what you're talking about.
I've had six so far.
All right. Well, I'm wrong. She has six. Way to call me out. But she's had six so far, but it's a way, what you said, where you're taking in everything people are saying and you're writing it down. You're having those discussions. And I don't think any politician has done that before.
Well, I don't know about any politician, but
I'll take the blame if it's wrong.
Yeah, but I'm just trying to do a public service that I want to see done, and that's how I ran my campaign, and that's how I am engaging in this new role. I'm not up there to be a seat warmer, and I'm not up there to be, you know, just like everybody else. I am there to actually be a thought leader and put the action, and take the actions necessary to move us forward. And it's actually really fun. So when you ask about like the negative attacks that come at me, it's okay. Because, like, I'll give you an example. The first community conversation I had last week. So I had three in November.
She's had six, by the way.
Yes, she's had six. Don't let us mislead you here on the show.
The district includes three towns, Greenwich, part of New Canaan, and part of Stamford. So I wanted to do one in each. I did three in November, and it was just me. And this last round, last week, I had a special guest at each event, and they were prominent business leaders who shared their expertise. But so the first one was in New Canaan, and we were forewarned that protesters would show up because the Connecticut GOP, the official party platform, sent out emails asking people to show up and protest. There were three protesters. And you know what? It was fine. There were three protesters. I knew one of them because I had already engaged with him via email. He lives in Stanford, Patrick Sasser. There was one woman. I went right up to them and I shook their hand. I said, thank you so much for coming. What's your name? Where are you from? She's from Middletown. You know, they weren't really from the district, but that's okay. They were all residents of Connecticut. And I asked her what her concerns were, and we talked, and I listened. Listening. It just goes so far in terms of building bridges. And, you know, and I am very sympathetic to everyone. I want everyone to do well. So, and then I invited them into the room and I called on them during the Q&A again, because I'm not afraid of dissenting opinions. Mm-hmm. I'm not really afraid of anything, but, by bringing every perspective and every opinion to the table and creating a framework in which we treat one another with respect and we listen and we rely on fact only.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
so that was the only sort of, touchy moment was someone.
I love that you called on them though. That's brave.
Well, it was because it was the guy, Patrick Sasser, with whom I had corrected him many times already. He keeps saying that my bill is 84 gantries. Well, you can just read the bill. It doesn't say anything about gantries. So, so perpetuating false information is, that's not acceptable, especially when you've already, when you know, and there's, you know, it's a clearly, erroneous, but everything other than that, passion, I fully, you know, accept and appreciate.
You talk about creating an effective and accountable government. So how do you do that?
Because so
you've taken on, now there's where I think you've taken on something.
We only have an hour.
Well, I've already caused a bit of a stir in my caucus, the Democratic Senate caucus. There's a tradition they call Senate time, which means that, you know, caucus is called for 1 o'clock, but people sort of maybe wander in at 1:45 or 2, or you never really know that it's not, nothing is punctual. Whereas in the House, apparently it is punctual to the minute. And there's really no reason for that. All of our time is valuable. And so I've already made several points of not abiding by Senate time, but saying, tell me when the meeting's actually starting. And that's when I'm going to show up, because I'm here to work every single minute.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've already pushed back on that system and made it more accountable.
What about transparency? And this goes across all of our institutions, but where there's no transparency, how can people come up? How can people really know where they stand? So how do you think the government can be more transparent with the people so that they can develop a sense of understanding or trust?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And that is really my mission, is to bring everyone into the process, because really what democracy is a system of self-governance. But if we are not governing ourselves, if we're abdicating that to somebody else and we don't really even understand the process, then it's not working. And that's sort of the point where we're at in our history. It's broken down.
It's like a codependent relationship with the government.
And then people rely on things like, you know, the news, or that, which unfortunately hinges on sensationalism and doesn't usually get into the real substance or show the entire landscape of an issue. So it takes work to be informed and engaged. But one thing I've been doing is I've been doing like videos and posts on exactly how the process works, so behind the scenes. Mm-hmm. And
I've watched it. So I actually thought it was really interesting. If you, it's Alex for CT at Instagram, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so if you go on there, like she does these very, they're very simple, but like it does teach people like myself who are not that well informed about politics, but it gives you like this easy breakdown of what you're doing, which is good because it's like you're using the power of social media because people are on there more than they're probably watching news or anything like that to give them an idea of like how it actually all works. So right. I appreciated it.
So oh, I'm so glad to hear that. And so today I just did one, and I want to send people to the website, which is it's our government website, cga.ct.gov. You can find, you just put in any legislator's name, you can see all of the bills that they have put forth, you can track the bills, you can figure out what you care about and learn how it's going. So even if you can't be there physically in Hartford, although I invite everybody to come because it's fascinating.
It's kind of far.
I do it every day.
Just drove in the storm to be here.
But you can participate in the process just by learning what's going on.
I did. Well, okay, so I'm not that great with the political process either, but in our doing the research for the show, I went on and I printed all the bills that you've submitted.
Excellent.
And it is, folks, go on now and take a look because it's www.cga.ct.gov. And you can see all the bills. Now, I've got a list of them here, Alex. Mm-hmm. Can I call you Alex?
Yeah,
or Senator
please.
Alex?
No, please call me
okay,
Alex.
I've got a list of all the bills that come up if I put your name in there to see what was submitted. And it's a long, long list. Mm-hmm. They're under your name on that website.
I drafted them.
You drafted them.
So that process started back in November. I really never stopped working after the campaign ended. As soon as I could, I went to Hartford. I met with, there's a wonderful resource there, a nonpartisan staff of lawyers, legislative research office, and then there's also legislative commissioner's office, sorry. And these are dedicated attorneys who will research any policy issue that legislators ask them to. And they're underutilized. They even told me, like, most representatives and senators don't even use their resources. But I did. I sat down with them. I told them these are my priorities. And I have a lot of priorities, like 36. And so we did research. I formulated the bills that I wanted to draft. And then I went over to the other office of lawyers who draft the bills. And that process took a few weeks because we had a deadline. The deadline was January 18th. So we were only sworn in on the 9th. And by the 18th, if we wanted to submit any bills, it had to be by the 18th.
You're sworn in January 9th.
Yeah.
And you really? That's crazy. Now fix that because that's insane.
Well, so it just means you got to get to work before you're sworn in, which is what I did.
You must have. Oh, so when did you start researching? Because when we're about to get into it,
You
submitted a lot of bills on a lot covering everything
from
the economy to people's values and rights.
Yeah.
And so when did you start to research your platforms, or did you always know them? Or
I actually started researching back in April because, as I come at everything with an open mind. So I didn't adopt a party platform. I did my own original research with the help of a friend who's a PhD economist and named Deirdre Kamlani. And we spent hundreds of hours researching all these different topics from pensions to everything. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I developed a very policy intensive platform during the campaign. And I'll tell you, a very seasoned politician said to me early on in the campaign, you really shouldn't talk about tolls because it's not very popular. Uh-huh. And I thought about it, but we had already done the research and concluded that this is a necessary initiative that we're really losing so much money than we could have access to. Anyway, so I took his advice under advisement and then I disregarded it. And I ran on a number of issues, but one of them was definitely tolls.
Has that politician ever approached you about that? Be like, you remember when I gave you that advice?
No, but like a lot of people, he said, wow, I'm so impressed that you won. Like, but it's when you tell people the truth, I mean, the public is smart. These people, I mean, everyone we know is intelligent and educated. They want the truth. Now, the truth isn't always, you know, like fairy tales and rainbows. The truth is complicated and messy, and there's always some give and take and some negative and positive. But that's what it takes to be to lead and to make decisions that are really going to impact our future. So,
okay, so let's go.
Yeah.
And let's go into starting with the economy and taxes. Let's start to go into some of the bills that you talked about, and there's many. So let's start with taxes, government spending, and in strategic investing.
Yes, great. I'm so glad you asked. So the most important thing to me is that we have a balanced budget, that we have that we keep our taxes low. I definitely will not raise taxes, income tax, corporate tax, anything like that. And there's a recent idea that was floated to increase the property tax by 1%. I came out in total opposition to that on the same day. So I don't hesitate. I don't wait to see like what my party is going to do or what anyone else is going to do. I just think about, you know, how's this going to impact our district? How's this going to impact our state? And I think raising taxes is the wrong way to go. We don't need to do that. So I'm in favor of lowering taxes. I've already put out bills to eliminate the estate and gift tax. And I also want to lower the income tax gradually, like Massachusetts did. That's the next step. First, and we have to balance our budget.
Why did you do gift and estate tax? Why was that like one of the main bills that you did?
Because we're one of the only states that has it. And we're driving people, we're driving basically high net worth people out of the state. And if they stayed in the state, not only would we collect their estate and gift tax, we would also collect an enormous amount of income tax that we're now losing. Plus, they would contribute to the economy and buy houses and, you know, hire people and all of that.
Move down to Florida.
Exactly. Exactly. So we're losing billions, but capturing just a very small amount. And the amount that we've captured in the last 5 years has gone down by 50%. So,
wow. See? Yeah. Didn't know that.
Yeah.
So when you say the government is out of the budget's out of balance. Mm-hmm. Is it primarily due to the pension fund, or and how do you keep taxes down? Mm-hmm. And what do you do? Reallocate? I'm just trying to see.
Yeah. Well, that's why. Yeah. So the unfunded pension liability is the albatross, and again, this is something that every other candidate would describe the problem, but not offer very little solutions, but not permanent solutions. And I was out there in front, and I still am. And one of my bills is to adopt a shared risk pension model, which is a complete restructuring of the pension, the public pension system, to put in fair and reasonable caps, calculations, retirement ages, and then also deliver full funding. So it would require a constitutional amendment that would require full funding. So, you know, I've spoken to many teachers, and mostly teachers actually, and firefighters and other people in who have public pensions, state employee pensions, and most people are really supportive because they understand that right now, even though they've been, you know, promises have been made to them, when you look at the actual funding of the pensions, they're very low. They're like between 35% and 55%, which means there's a huge amount of risk, not only for the people who are on pensions right now, but definitely for the people who are still working by the time they come up. What's going to be left? So, and their benefits have already been slashed. So a shared risk model that guarantees full funding so that people can really rely on their pensions, which is what it should be, security, is something that I've been advocating for a long time.
Okay.
And it would take billions off of our balance sheet, by the way.
Just to throw that in there.
Yeah. Have you been getting pushback on that? You have to.
You know, I push back from political opponents who like to say, oh, that'll never work. Okay, but it already has worked, and who don't offer any other serious alternatives. So, again, this is another example of one of these difficult conversations we have to have. But we're all grown-ups, and we should be able to handle the truth and talk about it, you know, in a civil, constructive way.
I also think that the generations coming up after us have a different perspective on pension. It doesn't mean we don't close the pension plan, but I think they'll have a different, more open-minded perspective because I don't think that they look at their security the same way the generations before us have had to.
Yes.
So we'll see. That may give us something to work with that we weren't able to work with in the past.
Yes, I agree.
A mindset. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're going to go to break. Folks, you're listening to Defy and Hustle. We're here with Senator Alex Bergstein. And do come back because we have a lot to talk about. She's on top of so many things. There's so many things we have to explain to you. So come on back. Hi, everybody. This is Noreen Ehrlich. And welcome back to Defy and Hustle. We've got Daisy Mello. We've got Bob at the controls over there. And we have our very, 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 very special guest, Senator Alex Bergstein, and she is here with us now, and we are going to talk a little bit about some of the bills she submitted within being sworn in on the 8th, you said, or the 9th? She was sworn in on the 9th of January, and you submitted
31 original bills, and I signed on to 5 others. Yeah.
Okay.
The first
31 original bills by the 18th of the month. Okay. So we're going to start to get into, why don't we talk about, if we're not going to raise taxes, we wanted to talk about finding efficiencies within the government, within the budget of the government. So why don't you talk to us a little bit about where you are finding those efficiencies?
Yeah, well, there have been some great recommendations that were made by commissions that have studied the budget, like the Bipartisan Commission on Fiscal Stability, Economic Growth, and others. And there are ways that we can save money. So one of the bills, for instance, that I proposed would ask Department of Social Services to outsource some of the services that they now provide. The state provides these services, but local nonprofits can just as easily, in fact, oftentimes provide them better quality and more efficiently, and definitely at lower cost, sometimes just a third of the cost of the state-delivered service.
Such as
housing for people with cognitive disabilities, such as support services for physical and mental conditions, all sorts of things. So, and I've spoken with people in the nonprofit community here. I've spoken with people up in Hartford to determine if this really is something that's viable. And every bit of feedback I've gotten confirms that, yes, we, instead of having this two-tiered delivery system, we should have a one-tiered model where the local nonprofits, assuming that they're qualified and they're doing, you know, the right thing by the clients, should deliver the services, and then the state can just take sort of a supervisory role instead of being in the business of delivering services. So I see everything through a public-private partnership model, and you know, oftentimes, not always, but oftentimes, the private sector, which includes nonprofits and businesses, are more than capable, in fact, really the best at doing whatever it is that they are designed to do. And government should take a step back, let them do what they do, supervise it, make sure that, you know, that the public interest is being served. But that's an efficient model.
So it's sort of like the way our financial systems, well, it's a little scary to compare it to that, but you have the SEC and you have the financial systems, and they're just making sure that...
Yeah, oversight.
There's just oversight.
Government oversight, without overstepping and without creating, you know, a burdensome and costly bureaucracy.
Okay, so why don't we talk about one of the issues that has been controversial for you, which is the tolls. You've been proposing putting tolls on the roads in Connecticut. And Connecticut, from what I understand, is would be a late adopter.
Yes.
Of
we're the
tolls.
Outlier.
Yes. So why don't you talk about that? Because you have been getting some pushback.
But first, I just want to define the term controversial, because I will tell you that the other night at Greenwich Library, I had an event. 300 people showed up.
I was one, yes.
Yes, you were there, so you can attest to this. There were 8 protesters. So eight angry protesters, 300 people inside the room applauding the toll initiative. So I don't know if it's, you know, how the story gets framed in the press is really key, but I think it's important for people to know that the vast majority of people in our district, and I know this because I talked to thousands of people during the campaign, vast majority support tolls because they understand that we're missing a huge opportunity by not having them. And the opportunity we're missing is the opportunity to actually transform our infrastructure, because if you're against tolls, that means that you are for the status quo, the system that we have been using up until now, which means you're totally fine with the fact that our train times have gotten slower, our roads have become more congested, and we're literally doing nothing about it. That is the system we have in place now. So to think that there's some, you know, magic silver bullet answer that's going to come around, no, the answer is what every other state has done, which is create a revenue stream that's mostly from out-of-state drivers. And the beauty about tolls now is they're electronic. We would use them for congestion pricing. It would significantly lower traffic during all times of the day. And we can use differential pricing, which is basically like a personalized pricing model. Because on one end of the income spectrum, you know, we don't want to, I definitely don't want to add any burden to struggling families. So we can have credits and exemptions for all sorts of different categories of people. On the other end of the spectrum, there are people, certainly many people here in Greenwich, who would gladly pay a premium to get into, to get access to a premium pass lane on the highway and get to their destination 20, 30, 40 minutes faster. Mm. So we're not capturing that revenue stream. What I'm proposing really is a fair market solution where the consumer decides what they want to pay for access to the highway.
This would be a lane that you pay. Is it like an HOV lane? You mm-hmm. have to be high mm-hmm. occupancy.
Well, excuse me.
Hold on. Wait.
let me answer this for you.
Yes. Daisy.
If you read my bill, I have put in another bill, which asked the DOT to consider making a special lane on 95 that would either – you could either access it if you're HOV, which means three passengers or more, mm-hmm. electric vehicle, or premium pass,
pay
meaning
premium
that you're
pass.
Willing to pay more. And, of course, all the details about how much you'd be willing to pay and where the sensors are, et cetera, all of that has to be worked out. And people – you know, the six protesters are –
Loved, all six of them.
Yeah, six yeah. of them love to talk about the 84 gantries that, well, anybody who reads my bill can see there's no gantries, there's no number of gantries, there's no details specified because all of that should be discussed. And oh, by the way, by the time we implement tolls, gantries may not even be necessary. We should be able to use sensors and attach them maybe to the lampposts, to the bridges.
Right, you wouldn't even know what was happening.
To the signage. Right, exactly. So
you also where would, talked about...
I just want to know where the tolls would be. I think people want to know like where they would be affected.
Okay, so that all those details have to be worked out. I can tell you what they wouldn't be. They would not be just on the borders.
Yeah.
That's not legal, and I would be against it anyway because we are a border town.
Mm-hmm.
But they would be spaced out. So, you know, and but people shouldn't, instead of thinking about where will the tolls be, it's basically a model where you're paying for access to the highways. We could have sort of a local zone where you pay a certain fee, like $15 a year. Another state has this. And then when you drive within like 10 miles of your home, you're not charged anything. There are all sorts of pricing models that
ways
are possible
that yeah. make this
we haven't
work.
Even begun that discussion yet mm-hmm. so people should I just want everyone to take a deep breath and like calm down and realize that you're actually your tax dollars have been spent maintaining the roads at and you're not getting any benefit from them. So when we talk about tax dollars being used wisely, this is a way to use your dollars wisely and to access this huge pool of private sector financing that is literally billions of free dollars sitting on the table of like venture money that would love to invest in our highways if we had an income stream, but we don't have an income stream.
I was looking at some of the money that was coming in from different states. It
yeah.
was up in the 400 million and above yeah. in many states. So,
well, I think about like Jersey driving through there. I'm like, oh, another toll.
Well,
another toll.
Jersey wouldn't be any fun. But let's go on to, yeah. let's go on to, I wanted to talk to you about industry and employment. I saw that you submitted bills around workforce pipeline and job creation.
Yeah.
So, why don't you explain to our listeners
yep.
what's your vision for workforce?
So well,
the
so again,
workforce
I have
pipeline. Sorry,
a broad plan to for the economic recovery of our state. And it's not about one specific policy or another. It's about the intersection of many different proven policies. So, for instance, one thing that I would like to do is see more public-private partnerships between educational institutions and employers. And I've already talked to UConn. They're doing this with employers up in stores and in Stanford. Bring in the employers who can't find the skilled workers that they need, partner them with educational institutions so they create a curriculum, maybe they place a teacher or professor in that school so that they can train, literally train the employees that they need, and upon graduation guarantee some number of positions. So that sort of model.
I love that works. Idea.
Yeah, that's what they do in Europe, and we've done it before. We just need to – it's starting right now, but we need to scale it. A couple other things we need to do, and I put bills in for this too, is attract and retain millennials to our state. So we need to keep people who have retired here, and we need to attract the next generation of workers. So I proposed a bill to explore the idea of allowing young people up, like between the ages of 22 and 32, to opt into the state employee health insurance plan, which actually could save the state money, because when you add a pool of young, healthy people to an insurance pool, it lowers the risk. And that would be a great way to say, hey, you know, young people, especially if they've already graduated from a school in Connecticut, we have all these amazing colleges and universities, like, stay here. And another bill I put in, which is I'm co-sponsoring with another representative, Carrie Wood, is to have a college loan forgiveness program, which is a public-private partnership with the employers and the state, so that if people who graduate from universities here in Connecticut stay here and work for 5 years, their loans would start to gradually be forgiven. And by that point, they stayed here 5, 6, 7 years, they're now going to buy a house, they're going to put down roots, they're a taxpayer, and then that's how we build the next generation.
Mm. Why are they leaving?
They're leaving because there's a very high cost of living in Connecticut. Mm-hmm. They're not finding the kinds of jobs that they want here. Mm-hmm. So bringing businesses to Connecticut is my priority. And that was actually the theme of the three conversations that I had last week. They were not referendums on tolls. They were actually discussions about what the business community needs in order to come to Connecticut and put down roots here. And I've spent a lot of time actually in the last few weeks going around and meeting with different businesses, everyone from NBC Sports to,
Businesses.
No, all kinds of businesses. Right. I'm meeting Pitney Bowes tomorrow because I want to understand what they need from a state, what they need to stay here and invest here, and so we can create a really dynamic, mutually beneficial relationship for the long term, so that we never, ever, ever have a repeat situation like we had with GE, where just it seems like all of a sudden they left. So we need to build open communication and partnerships with our business community and deliver the kinds of conditions that they need. And the business community says uniformly that we need to fix the fiscal crisis in our state, and we need to fix our transportation, our infrastructure.
I actually want to get into that, the transportation part. Yeah. Like, so you mentioned a couple of these bills that you have on here. Improvement of the new Canaan line, improvements to Talmadge Hill train station, and then 95 as well. What kind of improvements would you want to have, like, to speed your trains? Because I actually noticed in New Canaan there's a huge market for houses for sale and stuff. People are just leaving it, maybe because it's the access to the trains. It just becomes so difficult for them to go to New York City, like, for their jobs.
Yeah, that's why I put in those bills specifically about New Canaan, because the lifeline to New Canaan is the train.
Yeah.
And it's an incredible community. I mean, just I've really fallen in love with it.
Oh, I love it. When you go there, it feels so quaint, and like it feels like it's out of a movie. It's very like picturesque, and you walk around downtown, but the market is like flooded.
The real estate market is, they are very concerned, and they have reason to be, because if the trains are the lifeline, which they are, and the trains have literally gotten slower over the years, and now they're unpredictable, and there was a fatality recently. I mean, these are not good signals. So, and we can fix them. The technology exists, and we have the, we just need to allocate our resources and invest wisely and strategically, because again, this is the whole idea, is that when we invest wisely in our infrastructure and make mass transit consumer friendly, then we're making it business friendly. Businesses will flock to Connecticut because our location is exceptional. I heard a statistic the other day that the economy of New York City, the New York area, is $1.9 trillion. It is bigger than any other metropolitan area in the country. It's bigger than Silicon Valley by like fivefold. So, you know, we're right in the shadow of New York. We're really an extension of New York. If we could just get our act together and offer the sort of infrastructure and services that people expect, they would not only put their businesses here, they would move here. And that's what we need, is a whole new influx of residents to buy houses in New Canaan.
Yeah, buy all those houses.
And businesses who will bring jobs. And those jobs don't just benefit Fairfield County. They benefit the entire state. Because when we're bringing jobs and residents who pay taxes into our state, we're growing the revenue base. And then that revenue can be distributed throughout the state. And it also increases property values way beyond Fairfield County. So because people can now travel quickly, then they can move farther away from the corridor. So...
But you also, you're. What do you think? Things don't change. Like you're talking about the trains, and I was out of the Northeast for a little while. I worked in Manhattan for a long time, but then I was all around the world, and I came back lastly from California, and came back to the Northeast, and I was like, oh, it's a little bit still outdated here.
And so outdated.
I started working in the city for a bit, and the trains were late all the time, and I remembered 10 years prior they were not.
Yeah.
But that's just an example of something that's just festering, I guess, is the word that comes to me. Why do you think it's not just the politicians that are going to save us? What do you think needs to change in terms of a mindset that we all need to have?
Oh, I think that's such a great question, because that is what needs to change, our mindset. So we can't just expect our politicians and our leaders to fix it for us. That's a very sort of childlike attitude. We have to be engaged, and we have to be involved, and we have to be informed. And if we're not, then we really are part of the problem and not part of the solution. So I think that this is a really exciting time. It's not only a new chapter for Connecticut. It's really, I think we're on the cusp of a complete breakthrough in terms of our civic awareness and realization that we are responsible for our current conditions, for future conditions, and we can't abdicate that responsibility to anyone. So what I'm seeing happening, what I'm encouraging, is for people to look close and hard at what their legislators are doing. Look at their records, ask questions, keep them accountable, ask them, you know, well, you said this at that meeting last year. You said you were for early voting, but you voted against it. Why is that? And don't accept weak answers, basically. Mm-hmm. And if you don't understand the answer, because a lot of times, you know, politicians will give an answer that people don't really understand, but they're too embarrassed to say, I don't really understand. You know, they make it sound like, well, it's a procedural thing. Well, keep asking those questions, because that's how we learn and that's how we grow.
And don't allow yourself to be manipulated.
Yes.
By the powers that be. So you have to really start to think for yourself and do your own homework and understand that there is a lot of people that there are a lot of organizations, people that would like to encourage you to think one way or another, whether that's about fashion, whether that's about politics or everything in our lives. You really do have to step back and be able to say, this is what I want and this is what I'm going to be able to figure out how to do. And let me try and get to the source of that.
Yeah. And do your research and make sure that whatever you're espousing is fact. And if you're listening to something, if you're listening to a narrative, whether it's from a particular news source or people or a community that's negative over and over and over again, oh, the state is going, you know, to hell in a handbasket. Oh, those Democrats are all this, or oh, those Republicans are all that. You know, that's probably not the best source. You can turn around and say to that person or community, like, well, what are you doing about it? And if we change from a negative to a positive narrative, that becomes self-fulfilling. A negative narrative is also self-fulfilling, but so is a positive
one. Step out of the polarity and start to see something higher. We have to go to breakout.
Okay.
You and I could talk for a while. But we're here at Defy and Hustle. We have Senator Alex Bergstein here with us. And when we come back, we're going to talk about some of the value and rights bills that she's proposing. Come on back.
I was uptight, wanna let loose. I was dreaming a bigger thing.
Good evening. We're looking at a 37-minute ride here on the northbound Connecticut Turnpike from the state line up to Route 7. And on the Merritt Parkway north from the state line to Route 7, a 36-minute trip. A girl in Kenya dreams of becoming a doctor. An elder in Guatemala dreams of being part of a community. Reach out. Change their world. It will change your own. Unbound.org. I'm Jay Trelase in the 1490 WGCH Traffic Center.
From the WGCH Weather Center.
Earlier snow showers still leaving behind some locally slick conditions. Mostly clear skies tonight. Frigid lows minus 5 to plus 5. A wind chill advisory in effect through early tomorrow. Feeling as cold as minus 15. Tomorrow mostly sunny, very cold. Highs 10 to 15. Clear skies near 0 tomorrow night. Friday mostly sunny, highs right around 20, and mostly sunny near 32 on Saturday. I'm meteorologist Ryan Gallagher on 1490 WGCH.
Are you a business owner who's suffering from what I call the entrepreneur's dilemma? That means you have a successful business, but you're so caught up in operations that you are overwhelmed. Maybe you're capital constrained, or you just know that you can scale your business to another level, but you need help doing that. This is Noreen Ehrlich from Defiant Hustle Radio. I'm an executive coach based in Greenwich, Connecticut. For over two decades, I worked as a CFO and CPA in Wall Street's fast-paced real estate private equity industry, where I helped start up and turn around hundreds of underperforming businesses. Based on this know-how, I created a 100-day plan that I tailor to your business to make sure that you streamline operations, drive performance, and generate profits fast. Don't wait. Take advantage of my free 50-minute consultation by visiting my website at NoreenEhrlich.com or by calling me at 475-333-2173. Listening to Defiant Hustle Radio. I'm here with my co-host Daisy Mello.
Oh, hello.
And our very, 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 very special guest, Senator Alex Bergstein. So, Alex, Senator Alex, why don't we talk about environmental policy? When you submitted bills, you said this is in your wheelhouse. So, why don't you tell everybody why it's in your wheelhouse and some of the reason you're so passionate about some of the environmental bills that you're submitting?
Well, I spent most of my career as an environmental health advocate. I ran an organization called the Mount Sinai Children's Environmental Health Center. So I'm really interested and passionate about the impact of what we're putting out in our water and food and products and air on children's health and actually really all of our health. So things like pesticides and chemicals and products have been big areas of interest for me. And that was the research that Mount Sinai was doing. And then I would translate it for the public and I would take research to policymakers in Hartford and actually in Washington too and try to get good policy made. So even though I'm not on the Environment Committee, there are amazing women running it. Two of my fellow Democratic women, freshman women senators, and I've put a number of bills through, including one to reverse the pesticide preemption law. So people might not realize that we have a law in Connecticut that prohibits municipalities from enacting any sort of restriction on the use of pesticides beyond what the state restricts. So, for instance, if Greenwich wanted to say, you know, we don't want to allow people to use glyphosate, which is a highly carcinogenic pesticide that's found in Roundup, we wouldn't have the right to do that. We couldn't have sort of local rule over that. We couldn't say that pesticides can't be sprayed on your lawn during, you know, certain – because they spread through the air and they migrate over boundaries. So if you're allergic or you don't want something on your property but your neighbor is spraying it, you're getting it too. You're exposed. So anyway, so that is one bill, a very common sense
bill. But just to be clear, the state was saying that the municipalities were not allowed to enact their own bills.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And so you put something in place to try to reverse that.
To reverse that, yeah. So that municipalities can choose to be more restrictive than the state already is. Another bill I put through is to establish carbon pricing so that we can actually move to a clean energy green economy model. We haven't done enough to address climate change, and obviously time is running out, so that's a key.
What does it mean to establish carbon pricing?
Well, carbon pricing is a system whereby companies and others, institutions, would actually pay for the environmental damage that they're doing by consuming carbon. But if their business relies on the consumption of carbon, they actually would pay a price, and the price other companies or other institutions could offset that, could buy the carbon. So it's a fair market model. Because that's essentially what I believe in, is that we're all responsible for our actions, and we should also have the right to know what it is that's being done by companies or by institutions or by individuals, and everybody take responsibility. So if they're going to pollute, and if that pollution is legal, which, you know, all sorts of pollution is legal.
Yes.
That price should be borne by the person or the company creating it, so that there aren't externalities. So right now we have a system where there's all sorts of externalities, which means, you know, somebody creates something, puts something out there in the atmosphere, in the water, in the air, in the cosmetics. It does damage to consumers, to children, to the groundwater. And we, the consumers, bear the burden, the price of it, the cost of it.
The outdated model.
Yeah, that's called an externality. So
we all have to step up and take responsibility for the fact that if we're aware this is happening, then we all have to step in and try and fix it, because it's really a model that ran its course, and we have to start to change our model.
Exactly.
So we can turn around and like start attacking each other over each of them.
Yeah.
What else? Let's see. You had a state water plan.
Yeah. So that's actually a really interesting situation. People also might not realize that we do not, in Connecticut, have a plan to manage the quantity of our water table. And water is clearly a public good. We can't run out of water and expect to operate, but we don't have a system to manage who gets to use how much water. And companies, many companies have the right to, it's called a registration, to extract water from the ground. And there was a situation a couple of years ago where a company inadvertently drained a river. Well, then it can't be undone. They claimed it was inadvertent. But, you know, we can't allow that to happen. So the state water plan was something that was crafted by four state agencies and the utilities and the environmental groups over a period of time, a very well thought out plan, and it never went to a vote for political reasons. It was stopped dead in the water by, by a well-known lobbying group that is very anti every single regulation, but claims to be pro-business. So we need to get that codified. The last governor did push it through regulatory channels, but we need to codify it so that we can protect our water.
When you submit these bills, so I know I was young enough to watch Channel 13 and then I'm just a bill on the hill, but what, you submit all these bills, 36 of which you were part of them or responsible for them, right? You took the lead on them. And so
what's the process?
Now what starts to happen?
Yeah. Oh, it's so fascinating. So there are a few dozen committees, And each bill gets referred to the committee that has cognizance over that bill. So, for instance, my gun safety bills were referred to the Judiciary Committee, and I happen to be the vice chair of Judiciary. I'm also the vice chair of Transportation, and I'm the chair of the Banking Committee. And I sit on two other committees. So all of these bills get farmed out to those committees. Then the committee chairs and vice chairs do screening meetings where they talk through them and they decide what they're going to do. Are they going to call for a public hearing? Are they going to put it on hold? How they're going to manage it? And then eventually some of them get a public hearing, and then maybe some of them get drafted into bills, and then maybe some of them get called to the floor of the House or the Senate and voted on, and only a very few actually get passed in the end.
You have to keep pushing on them.
Let's hope that some, maybe what, of your 36 get all passed.
Yes, thank you. Go in there. Folks, you have to go on to www.cga.ct.gov and look up what Alex Bergstein has put through, submitted as bills. Take a look. Participate. Don't complain. Start to immerse yourself in the process, and then we can do something about it together. Thank you so, so very much for being on the show, Senator.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.